All right, we are live. Welcome to another episode of Roasting Marshmallows. My name is Rolf Suet, and I am your host. We are, as of recording this podcast, in lockdown again due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The Omicron variant is running rampant, so this means most of us are working from the kitchen table, or if you have the room, from your home office again. This means that entire teams are working remote, not physically meeting each other for an extended period of time. So how do you make sure everything keeps running smoothly? How do you make sure communication, coordination, and control do not degrade due to an increased distance of the team? Luckily, the software engineering industry has had decades of experience working with remote teams. Near and offshoring has been pretty common, and the lessons learned from that can be applied to working from home. And, to help us pinpoint the takeaways from these lessons, we are roasting marshmallows with Rini van Solingen, speaker and author on speed and agility of people and organizations. Rini is a professor at Delft University of Technology, and he investigates how to make global teams hyper-productive and how to decrease the impact of distance in global software engineering. Rini has written several books on topics about changing leadership, accelerating organizations, agile transformations, and Scrum. Welcome, Rini.
Wow, thank you. Thank you for the introduction.
Yes.
Great to be here.
You're welcome. So I did a good job with the introduction?
Oh man, I get, I'm going to walk next to my shoes, as they say in the all modesty is out of the window.
Well, I mean, because you're on Amazon with your books, and you've got some publications, and you co-wrote a few books. Well, not a few. You co-wrote one with Jeff Sutherland, for example, which rings a couple of bells, of course. And I think there are some more people, that you wrote some books with that are pretty well-known names. So, I was at least thoroughly impressed. So,
Thank you. And today we're going to talk about my hobby, global software engineering or remote work.
Yeah, for sure. Because, you know a lot about that, and you teach about that at the university as well. And, I think Panche has had some experience with remote working as well, because Panche, you used to have a company that that did some nearshoring work for Dutch companies, right?
Yeah, so some 10 years ago, I ran a company basically here in Macedonia, where I'm currently located, which I sort of escaped the lockdown in the Netherlands and flew here. So some of the perks of, let's say, offshoring and working in this digital domain. So yeah, I know quite a lot about running teams at a distance and how to create some sort of integration and unity with the remote teams.
Yep.
So yeah, quite interested also in Rini's stories and obviously his research on the topic.
Yeah. So we can all right. That's pretty cool. So let me just introduce Sylvester so we have the introductions out of the way. Sylvester, what is your experience with working remote?
Working remote? Well, for the last 2 years, I think we've been doing quite a bit of remote work. My experience is that it can be tricky to stay connected. And I think that's the thing I'm most interested to learn today, how we can tackle that to stay connected as a company and to stay together.
And what is your experience with offshoring? Do you have any experience with them? Yeah.
Well, actually, in the time, I think it's when you wrote your book, Rini, Scrum for Dummies with Michael Franke. I was working for a company then who sent me to India to fix an internal project. I think it was a website or something. And then I learned why offshoring, as in the typical sense, right? Here, do this for us, doesn't really work. And it's more about, what do you want to achieve? How do you make a team? And, stuff like that. And I think that was my... the typical introduction to why offshoring doesn't work. Right. So I'm looking forward to this conversation. And again, thanks for responding to the invite after our somewhat clumsy marketing message, but we're fixing that. We're on it and we'll make it work.
Well,
happy to be here.
Maybe the marketing message did work because now we're talking to Rini.
That is true. That is true, actually. Yeah.
So, Rini, what exactly are you teaching at Delft University? Because, like, when I was in university doing software engineering and stuff like that, they never really taught me anything about working with other teams, remotely. So I guess that is changing. Because, So what is it that you teach the students about it?
Yeah, I'm working at a technical university, yeah. So, yeah. Which means that, let's say, the majority of our students after the university, they go into business, they go to practice. It's right. Not like that where some go pursue a PhD, but in general, they become software engineers.
Yeah.
However, let's say traditionally universities also really be set up as being, let's say, educational to be only become an academic. And especially then we look to computer science or technical informatics, we tend to focus on programming. We tend to focus on technical sides of testing. We tend to talk about development pipelines, architecture, which is all fine, eh? Because you know those are the practices, the skills you actually need when you go into practice.
Yeah.
On the other hand, especially from a technical perspective, we tend to focus, I think, too much on those, or at least very much on those. If it's too, it depends. And we tend to forget what we would say in common terminology called a T-profile. A T-profile says you have broad knowledge and deep knowledge, and we tend to focus on the deep one only. So you get people with an I-profile.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in general, we should know more about other technologies. So when you're a software engineer, you should know also a lot about mechanics, electrotechnics, and stuff like this on the technical side. But I think you should also know stuff on the collaboration side. Well, I'm a part-time professor, which means I have the benefit that, let's say, I'm only one day a week at the university, and then you can also go into a research line, which is a little bit on the outside. Mm. And in fact, that's what I'm doing. So if you look to the department where I work in, many people focus on the technical sides of software engineering, and I'm also focusing on the collaboration aspect of it.
Yeah.
And when we started it off, we really focused, let's say, we focused on the distributed collaboration because it also involves technical challenges. But let's say, I think more than half of the success factors are non-technical when working remotely.
Yeah. Okay.
And I run a course on that. So that's every quarter, there's a course. Run remotely. It was already was a couple of years because I thought, you know, when you teach remote software engineering, the course should be remote as well, and which made when the pandemic came, I had some extra efforts.
Yep.
But let's say 90% of the work was already done. So now we're teaching it remote, and the students can collaborate remotely in a remote software engineering class.
And so did you notice that there's a lot more demand for a class like this in the last 2 years? Or?
University processes tend to go slow. Eh? So it's, it's a yearly class.
Yeah.
Students make their plan a year in advance, so it's. I can't say that. Let's say the first year in the pandemic, I've seen it dramatically in the numbers.
Yeah.
But I could expect that, like, by this time in of this coming year, the coming semester, things is going up. But the numbers are not there. Students, in some way, tend to wait to the last moment to register for a course. What's right. Sure, I was with you and your guys in your times of education. I remember I was always also late, so in that sense.
Yeah.
I was already scared when you said a year in advance, but.
Yeah, but roughly for the course, and they think about a little bit, what do I want to do? But for an elective course, which is what I teach, most students, they decide on the last responsible moment, which I think is fine.
Yeah.
I happened to notice when you were describing the T-profiling of the courses and of the skill sets, you specifically used the terms collaborative side and technical side. And normally in industry would hear like soft skills and hard skills. And I'm pretty sure that your choice of words is deliberate.
Yeah. And the reason is that I like to use words in general, which do not qualify or disqualify.
Mm-hmm.
And in hard skills and soft skills, it depends on the language. Yeah? So it's that depends on the context. At least in my world, in the technical world, hard skills and soft skills do not level.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well,
which extent you can decide yourself. But I think, well, you know, it's not.
I like
soft skills are not soft. Well, hard skills are often not hard. So that's why I think the hard versus soft is not fair. I think it's not. It's both. So that's why I use different terms.
Yeah. I think we agreed, but it was just an observation of your terminology, which should be probably better adopted outside in the generally in practice and in the industry, because through our work, what we discover is basically there is nothing soft about collaborative skills. It's actually what most of people in our domain of work actually find really, really difficult to do.
Yeah, and also it has something like hard is strong, is durable, while soft is weak. And I think, you know, in the hard and the soft, there is a qualification, disqualification. So, and I think it's not about hard and soft. It's versus, it's technical and it's collaboration. I think both are very important. Like in your brain, also the emotion and the intuition are just as important as the rationalization and the thinking. The right and left have a purpose, and they need to work together.
Yeah.
Cool. So, you know, I read your article on AG Connect about, you know, what we can learn about, you know, working from home again from the offshoring stuff. Because the story you described there is, you know, really hit home for me as well, because at my first job, we had a development team in India, and also my manager back in the day, he asked me, you know, can you go over there, get to know the team? And, you know, because we also had a pretty poor work relationship with those guys, because, yeah, you know, everything that they made, we felt that, yeah, it's, you know, subpar, and you know, it was never really what we wanted out of them. And then when you go over there, you find out, you know, these are pretty decent people. They're actually super smart and really nice guys. But yeah, just the way that we worked together just didn't work. So, and like I said, in your AG Connect article, it was basically the same story.
Maybe I should repeat the story.
That might be a good thing.
Not everybody understood. No, I think there's a couple of stories to tell, but this one was really interesting. The first time I went into, of course, I knew the theory and stuff, but when I really ended in an offshore practice was when I was a CTO of a product company, and we had four engineers working for us in India via a partner.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And my Dutch guys were always complaining about the guys, and they were not understanding stuff, and they were I wouldn't say they were stupid, but, you know, they didn't really make use of it. But, okay, we can't find people, so let's do it to India. But it's more work, and they never deliver quality. The Indian guys were always complaining, you know, they were left out of the discussions. They were given orders. When they had alternative solutions, which were much faster and better, the discussion was already made. So, and one every 6 months, we would try to visit it. But then we invited one of the engineers to come and stay over for a longer period. And let's hypothetically call the engineer in question Anand. And Anand came to the Netherlands, stayed in the hotel next to the office, was there, I think, 1 or 2 months. And, you know, smart guy, very friendly, very intelligent, great humor, brilliant work ethics. And, you know, my engineers learned from him.
Yeah.
Also on technical side, he was pretty good in .NET, which was also new at the time. So Anand was really brilliant. So because it was not Anand, it had to be the other three. That was their conclusion.
Of course.
The conclusion was, you know, if it's not Anand, it has to be the other three. Yeah? It can't be us. It can't be us. And the funny thing was when Anand went back to India, it worked for a couple of weeks, up to 3 months, and then the whole hassle came back.
Yeah.
And that's about the time that's the second law of Rini. The second law of Rini is that when you work remotely, you should meet at least every 3 months. Yeah. Could make it four, and meet is also has some alternatives. It doesn't really have to be flying, but you have to be very close for a longer term in a mental space where you're not discussing work or in planned meetings, mm-hmm. where you really connect with somebody. Yeah. And I think on the skill level, we have developed ourselves in the last 2 years. And also the technology side stuff have happened, which, let's say, have changed things. But maybe we can later come to that, because distance, I think, is a perception.
Yeah.
And you can manage it. So that's the second law. The first law of Rini, by the way, is that a team is not a team until they have been drunk together, co-located. you can also get drunk from tea. Yeah, it's not about the alcohol. It's just, you know, you have to sit in late, talk about anything, have fun, sing songs and stuff like this before you become a team. So that was the interesting a part of the story. And then, you know, 2 years ago, I ended up in my current company I'm leading, and all my colleagues in the Netherlands were sitting at home. And we saw after 3 to 4 months the same shit happening again.
But then the other way around.
My language, the same, the beep happening happening again. And the same stuff we saw over there. And then we realized ourselves is that when you bring distance into a collaborative relationship, you know, then you start to involve the three C's that you just also so introduced. Yeah. And in fact, we having the same offshore problems that we had before, but now we're offshoring to the kitchen table.
Yeah. So what was your strategy to tackling now this sort of local offshoring to the kitchen table?
There's a couple of things, of course. First thing is it starts with acceptation. That was also the story what we had with Anand and Indy. It started with acceptation and to realize, you know, it's not them, it's you. Apparently, we've organized it in a way where this could happen. So that's also the good news for any leader who sees problems happening in his environment and doesn't need to be a manager. Everybody's a leader, but any leader who's in an environment who realizes that it's suboptimal always can come directly to the conclusion, so that's me. And then the funny thing is when you start to realize it's you yourself, you can deal with it much easier than when coming to the conclusion that it's not you, it's them, because you can't change them and then you accept the situation. So
the only thing you can address is yourself. Anyway,
sorry, what did you say, Panchi?
The only thing you can actually address is yourself if you're actually willing to address
anything.
Exactly.
Look at it when you accept it or something. That's one thing. And the second thing that you should look at, let's say, what negative influences are there from distance? Well, the theory is pretty clear. There's books written over it. And I think, you know, whether you do a 4C or a 3, 4, 5 dimension, it all comes back to that communication is harder. Misunderstandings occur easier. The coordination is harder because you can't see who's doing what. So you have to find out who's doing what and when. And the third wing is the control. You know, are we in control? Are we delivering the right stuff at the right moment? It's harder when you're not together. And you have to find countermeasures to tackle these.
What are these countermeasures? Because to me, those are actually the same things that make a high productive team, right? Being able to make decisions on your own, autonomy, stuff like that.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things you can do. Eh? So if communication happens unorganized or ad hoc, that's fine. And you start to introduce distance, the ad hoc goes away. So you need to plan it in. I can't make it prettier than it is. So you have to plan in also non-planned communication. So you have to plan it in. So which means, let's say, if you're an organization, by the way, who does a daily, try to at least do a double daily. So stuff like this, try to work together with the camera open. So not just use it for a meeting, but start a day with open. One of my favorites at the moment, and we're talking now, what's it, Sylvester afternoon 2021. What I like is the Mebo, the getmebo.com. They have the town hall, the Mebo town hall, which is even a professional environment where you have breakout sessions where you can collaborate, and it mimics co-location. It's not, but it's way better than Teams or Zoom with just a video conferencing. You can walk up to somebody, you can sit together, share screen. So I think that we come to that point is that distance, though it's a fact in kilometers, but the negative consequences of distance are also in perception of distance. And we've worked on that. I mean, you know, it's very logical that you and I, the four of us now do this remotely. Mm-hmm. 5 years ago, we would have joined up in the studio. Yeah. Punchy would have to fly in, or bad luck, Punchy, you can't join. Things change radically. So in the way we deal with each other, how the technology came into our house, how we have wired connections in all rooms, things change completely over there. But also in the environments, like the Getmebo, but also you have Sococo or Wonder. That's our environment.
Gardatown is the one we're using. Yeah.
The trend to mimic the way we are co-located. And I think these technology are in their infancies. And I think, you know, in time, this will change. Facebook is investing into the metaverse. I'm not sure what that will be, but we will see technology coming up, which is influencing or decreasing the perception of distance. And you know, when we don't perceive distance, it's gone.
I still remember that actually. When we started using our virtual office, we also created offices for a few of our clients. And the funny thing is, you can just walk to a client. It's kind of like a game, of course, right? And you're instantly there. And that effect, that stayed with me. So I'm not getting in my car. I'm not scheduling a meeting. I'm just walking over there and, hey, here I am.
Yeah, but nowadays you get into the office and you turn on this system. And it's still a mental thing. Oh, I have to put on the video conference. Oh, I have to. But I think in time, you know, if this becomes really part of our being, it's just, you know, it's the first thing you do. Now you log into your laptop or your PC, but then you log into the virtual environment. Yeah. And I think, you know, then the new thing gets away and it becomes part of your life. And then you actually start to decide, you know, for which purpose will we travel? And I think we can learn from, there are companies who started asynchronous from scratch.
Yeah. Yeah, like GitLab and the likes. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So whether you can transform that way is another discussion. But I think, you know, at least you can learn their lessons. And they still meet. It's not that they never meet, but they meet for the purpose of having the physical bodies of the employees being together. Yeah, and they would consider it a waste of doing a meeting when you're together. Exactly. Because we don't have to fly together to have a meeting. No. So let's use it for what it is, you know, to have a drink, to do some sports, to play a game.
But still, like, I've had a few virtual drinks, and it is different than being physically in a bar somewhere, having a drink with your colleagues. You know, these virtual drinks, it's cool, but it is different. But maybe it's just me getting used to the idea, but...
Yeah, but it also depends what you're still learning, Rob.
Yeah.
So the first time you do something, you know, you're the worst at it. So of course, the first virtual drinks will not be the greatest one. The first ball where you went to in real life was also not the best one.
Probably.
I mean,
not,
you know, though. You have to. What are these unspoken rules? How does this work? If I get a beer, I get a beer for the other guy. Hey, I'm now virtual. I can't get. I mean, this is strange. You have to get to adapt. But I can tell you the story that a year ago, one of my best friends turned 50. And it was in the midst of the lockdown in the Netherlands. We couldn't go anywhere. And normally we would go for a weekend away or for a night away. But it wasn't feasible. So what we did is we sit on the Meebo on the island. And we did a beer tasting contest. But it was some preparation. So we had to order 5 types of beer. We had to take the etiquettes off. We had to send them to the people. Don't open it. So at the same time, we would open the bottle, drink it together. The strange thing was, after 5 Belgian beers, well, of course, my perception started to also be a little bit influenced, but I really had the feeling I was having a night out with my buddies.
Yeah,
I knew the guys before, so it's also a different thing is, do you know the people that you meet in virtual environment or not? Yeah. The craziest thing, Rolf, was when we stopped, so when the session ended.
Because what happened?
I was home immediately.
Yeah,
I'm 50 years old. You know, how many nights out did I have with the guys? How often did it never occurred to me that when I drank my last sip, I walked out of the bar, I was home immediately.
Yeah.
Never. And even sometimes the road lasted longer than on the way to the pub. But now with one push, I was home. That was the point that I also again for me got the remembering. Distance is a perception.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I think it's. I don't think that one will fully replace the other one, but I think it should be a total. It's a different experience of socializing with one another, which has its ups and downs. I think just being in a bar with the whole atmosphere of a bar, surrounded with also other people, the bar chatter, the smell from food being brought to other table, going to the dirty bathroom. I mean, it's like part of an experience, right?
Well, exactly. So you have to go there for that experience. Oh, yeah. And that's one of the strange thing is that, like you mentioned that you go to the toilet. That's one of the funny thing that I think with these virtual meetings, when you have a bio break, everybody turns off the camera or something. It's like, you know, when you go to the toilet, you put a bag over your head. it's.
We had a few occasions.
It's strange. You can leave your camera on and walk away.
Yeah, we had a few occasions where people kept their mics on and the headset and just went to the toilet. So that's a bit.
Let's not go that way. Yeah.
But, but I mean, we're talking a lot about distance now. But you know, one of the other things that I experienced, at least, was which was hard for me to get around, was a difference in culture, which of course you may or may not have with your current company. When we're saying like, oh, we're just going to work from home, then there might not be a huge cultural difference. But yeah, at least with the team up in India, we definitely had some cultural differences. So how would you approach that?
Oh, that's a great story. That's a great. Let the short version. Version, Rolf. There are different types of cultures.
Yeah.
And national culture is just one of them. Mm-hmm. And it happens to be that there are other cultures which are pretty much more stronger than national culture. But if you don't do anything, you know, people, then they run home to mommy and daddy, what they learn from. So one of the things, for example, which is stronger than national culture is the company culture. So in fact, it can happen that you have a company culture where it's okay to say no, even when you're from India. While we hear everybody, Indians cannot say no, they cannot juggle their head. No, also Indian people can say no, of course. They've learned from their mommy and daddy that it's impolite. So if you have a company culture where it's okay to say no, and people, you help them with that, you train them, it's pretty okay. Yeah. And it's not that when they then come home to their father and mother, then they say also no to them. No, because they can context switch.
Of course.
So in the one context, no is not an answer, in the other one it is. But even more stronger than company culture is the professional culture. A professional culture, I mean the culture of your profession. Yeah. Like you don't ship untested software as a software engineer. Even though your company says it's okay to do, then you'd rather quit, call in sick, work the whole night to test it, because it's against my professional ethics to ship untested software.
Yeah, but that also takes some time for most engineers to come to that realization that that's okay.
Exactly. So and I go to the fourth one, but now you already explained to yourself that cultures can be changed.
Of course. Yeah. Okay.
And the fourth one, the most dominant culture is team culture. So that's why it can happen that within a team, they ship untested software.
Yeah.
Even though it goes against their professional ethics, the team culture can still be stronger. And that's why gangs, etc., or why small groups of people can be so strong. So the fact that you get confronted in a situation where it doesn't run, it's you, so it cannot be culture. So the first thing, it's their culture, is already, it's not me. So that's, be careful about that. But it also means that apparently there was no clear team culture. You hadn't worked on it. There were no team values. There were no agreements or working principles. It was not established in the professional culture. It was not established in the company culture. Yeah, then you sometimes experience national culture. But the main reason for me is, I always try to say culture doesn't matter, because you don't work. I'm not having this recording today with a Serbian person with a Serbian culture. Well, I'm talking with Panchi. But Panchi is a great guy.
I'm Macedonian, not Serbian. I'm sorry, just for the record.
Oh, no, I make a big mistake.
That's like... let's not go there.
I'm sorry, Panchi. Record. You're not in... Where are you at the moment in?
I'm in Macedonia. I'm Macedonian.
You can call me German from now on, Panchi, please. you can sell him from Germany now.
I need to think of worse than that. I mean, like calling your German.
Oh, okay. Let's not go there. My sincere apology.
No worries.
But let's say, in a way, I'm not talking to a Macedonian person. I'm talking to Panchi, and Panchi is not of the Macedonian culture. Yes, of course, he may cook great Macedonian food, and he might love Macedonian music, and there are brilliant Macedonian museums to go to. But to generalize Panchi to the Macedonian culture would be an insult in a way. I mean, he should
I agree.
I mean, it's for every person. Like, we all belong to different cultural groups. In the same time, we belong into, I don't know, hundreds of different cultural groups. And that is actually what creates essentially a unique person.
Exactly. And that's why I say I work with Anand.
Yes.
Or I work with Panchi. Or I work with Sylvester. Or with Rolf. Or with all other guys. And I think as soon as I let it into me that when things go wrong or not the way I want, or there is some friction or whatever, that is due to their national culture.
Yeah, that's poor excuse.
Me.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's 1.2 billion people, 1.2 billion people in India. I mean, right. How can it be that we generalize them to the same kind of behavior or traditions? I mean, I'm from the Netherlands. We're with 16 million and even, or 17 million, and even, you know, people from Groningen versus people from Brabant or Limburg versus, I mean, you know, this prejudice everywhere. So I think, to me, I think, you know, the culture is the ideal scapegoat for everything that goes wrong on your own side.
Oh, exactly what you say when you don't, when you fail to practice acceptance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but it's a good that Panchi says it. We also experienced that in the past 2 years. While there are unspoken traditions or unspoken rules or how we behave in meetings, we've moved these meetings to a virtual environment, the team meetings, and then you saw totally different behavior. Mm-hmm. You saw people answering phones in the midst of a meeting. Have you ever been into a physical meeting where somebody had the guts to pick up his phone and answer it? No, of course not. We have experienced in the past 2 years that people that needed to go to a toilet break in the midst of the meeting, they didn't say anything, and they went off, or they went to the door to pick up a package or something. And that's not because of the people or the culture of the person. It's because we did not make new agreements.
Right.
Yeah.
So you have to realize this, is that you say, oh, now we are in a new setting which resembles the old one. So some of the rules may still be valid. Some we can ditch, but we have to add a few.
Yeah, we probably still need to figure out exactly what those patterns of collaboration are.
So anytime you feel something, say, I believe this is not right. And maybe you can even feel, you can feel the other one is doing something stupid, or I don't, but then it's also you. But you realize, you know, oh, because I think that it has to be me. Then you can always say, something's happening. Are we okay with this? I mean, I feel a little bit awkward in this situation. Am I the only one? And if it's not, you know, what can we agree upon?
But then it's also about speaking up, right? Yes. Addressing the issue. And I think that could be part of your culture or principle or whatever you want to call it. But
yeah, okay. But then let's say in your normal working routines, there are all the reflection moments, whether you do a retrospective when you work for Scrum, or, you know, there are moments in which you reflect, or even when it's over a beer or something.
It is, though, a bit more difficult in a virtual settings for people to speak up.
Yeah.
We are not that attuned to, normally if we're together, we could just see sometimes body language that somebody want to say something. And here, when somebody's talking, it's kind of, you don't want to interrupt them. It's more difficult to interrupt. So kind of things go, people are like, oh, okay, I'm just going to...
Yeah, but the tooling, many toolings have solutions for that, right? Like you can raise a hand you can type something in the chat.
But I'm not sure it's a tooling, right? It's also about getting to know each other on a different level. Like, well, we know each other kind of now, right? So we know how to talk to each other. We know how to read faces, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. I think I even know the difference between Macedonia and Serbia.
Exactly. We're learning.
I just remember a story about this, Sylvester. So, I thought you were finished.
That's fine.
Because I joined Four Scouts about a year and 2 months ago something like that. And after a couple of months, you both guys told me, why would you just walk away from a meeting? And we were even co-located then.
In real life, yeah.
In real life. And then we figured out, like, I was not being upset or anything. For me, we're just like, we conquered most of the things about the meeting that we were supposed to talk, like the points. Then conversation went completely, like, off track onto something. I was like, all right.
Well, for you it did, right? We were just sitting there having a meeting, and you just see Pansis getting up and walking away. And we're like, what happened here?
It's a Macedonian thing, yeah?
Okay. I like it.
No, it's not. It really isn't.
But we addressed it. We talked about it. And, established some kind of shared value there.
Yeah, so let's say for culture, and also in my discipline, there's pretty some research done on it. And of course, you kind of, it's good to know each other's culture. It's good to dive into it, so because there's better understanding why people behave if you understand a little bit about the background and their common norms and values, which is okay. Culture is great because that's why we travel. Mm-hmm. And that's why we go to other places to eat other food, hear different music, have different religions around, different symbols, colors and stuff. So culture is fun. So it made short circuit in my head, you know, that culture could be a problem. It probably is something else, and one of the things that I've noticed in my life, and maybe Panchi can confirm that from his experience of nearshoring, is that we learn when we work remote. So with companies that started to work with India, for example, they make all the mistakes they can make, and then they say, well, I have to stop with this, doesn't work for us. And then a couple of years later, they said, now we still shortage of people. Let's not go to India because it didn't work for us. Let's go nearshore. And it's, nearshore is much better. These guys are much more intelligent and they speak better English. And, you know, it works much better.
Yeah.
But I've also seen the other way. I've seen people that started off with nearshore because their colleagues were so enthusiastic. Didn't work for them because they did everything wrong they could do wrong. Then they go for offshore to India and say, this is much more better with the people in India because we have advantage of time zones, this and that. It's not in them. It's not in whether it's the people nearshore or offshore. It's in you. It's the way you organize offshore. And it's because of the distance, it's harder. Mm-hmm. So you need to work with shorter iterations. You have to manage more. You need more. And if you put that in place, you have the benefits. And of course, the negative impacts of distance, because they don't go away. But it's not whether it's nearshore or offshore. It's how you organize it.
Yes, how you collaborate. I think that you were spot on, right, when you started. This is about collaboration. How do you work together? Is it one team or is it two teams in separate countries?
So to me, in the beginning when we started, it was obviously for a lot of people who were in the Netherlands, based in the Netherlands, this was just a new way of working. And not everybody was really willing to adapt to this new way of working. So it took quite a while for people to adjust to basically, new forms of communication, new forms of new tooling to some extent. And that takes time. And I think, what did you say? It was Rini's law number two, meeting face to face and getting drunk together. That helps immensely.
Yeah, that's rule number one. Eh? Drunk is the rule number one.
Yeah. Oh, that was the rule number one. Yeah.
And,
meeting people often was the rule number two. Yeah. So then we did this, and then the team that I ran grew over a period of a couple of years. Then, like, it was even more needed. So then we actually discovered the fact, okay, if we do meetings, so at some point we were able to either people from Netherlands come to Macedonia or people from Macedonia to Netherlands, like, every 2 months. That was, like, it was so great. And like, you see the bondage in teams, like, people were ordering between the teams. Oh, he's going to bring me this, he's going to bring me that. And it's like, it was this camaraderie, and people were bonding on a completely different level.
Yeah. You don't see the bonding between the teams itself, but between the individuals.
But teams, like, I've always been thinking, you don't make relationship between companies or between teams. No. You make relationship with people. Mm-hmm. And that's what it is. And we have this perception of, we work great with this company. It's like, the moment the people that you have worked with in the past are changed, that is gone.
That triggers me another question. You know, it's part of the research that I've done with a colleague of mine, Daria. And it's in the university, the research where we're investigating the cost factors of offshoring. So we were looking, what determines the rock bottom price?
Yeah.
And we did a broad investigation, and we started off, of course, it should be salaries or something. But it wasn't. There were two major factors determining the rock bottom cost of offshoring. Can you do a guess?
What do you mean a rock bottom cost of?
In the end, offshoring costs you 100,000 per employee, or a million per employee, or 10 euro per employee on a yearly basis. But what are the factors that influence this rock bottom cost figure? We thought it was salary, but it wasn't.
Communication.
I think it would be appreciation to some extent, showing appreciation to people.
Rolf,
I think like the amount of like missed deadlines, like the work taking a lot longer than anticipated.
Could be, but we really looked at the engineering level, so we did not look at the output of their work. Eh? Right. So that we also can put it that to the equation. Now the surprise was to us was it was not in the hourly rates. It was not on the travel cost or something. The two most dominant factors were attrition and learning curves. Mm. So attrition means how long does somebody stay around? And the second one, how long does it take before you can fully work for the customer in the product that you're working in? And especially the combination of the two, so a long learning curve, making, let's say, you need at least 2 years because you're really considered 100% software engineer for this domain, and a high attrition were deadly. So that, let's say, and that was the interesting part, is that attrition itself, that's what I've learned at least, attrition itself is in many situations given. And maybe you can do a little bit about it, but there are countries, and there are periods of time. We're currently again in one. We talk about the war on talent or the big quit at the moment. But you can't work. You can do something about attrition, but it's limited. But you can do something as a company on your learning curves. So you can do something regarding the way you organize work, the way you set up the product, how the architecture is given. Is that, let's say, the scope of an engineer that he has to have knowledge about to be impactful or effective can be really big. You have to know everything first before you can do a single change. Mm-hmm. Or can we shrink it that the focus becomes much more tighter? That you say, well, you can be valuable for our company in a much shorter period of time. And because of that, we are less dependent on you because, so attrition itself again becomes less of a burden.
But you mentioned that this was the factor for determining rock bottom cost for nearshore. Is that only for nearshoring? I would imagine for...
No, that was for offshoring.
Oh, okay.
For remote work, so we did it in an offshore setting, but we were really investigating the rock bottom cost factors, and for us it was really a surprise that this combination of learning curves and attrition determined the cost. So in fact, to which country you offshore does in fact not matter.
It matters.
You know, how high is the attrition and what can you do about the learning curves. And if you shorten the learning curves, maybe hiring locally could still be rock bottom more cheaper if there's no attrition.
Is that the only way to tackle this? You mentioned it briefly, but I actually believe that you need to involve people, right? No matter where they are, and if they kind of believe in the product, or they understand what they're building, or thinking along, you will be able to motivate people, well, way better, to attract them, to keep them more part of this. Lower your cost, right?
And I think that's absolutely right. You know, long-term connectivity and connection between people and the motivation, it's also true. But it was triggered by what Panchi said about the people and meeting each other and stuff like this. That triggered this discussion to me, that when we narrowly focused on what does a software engineer actually cost, but when we make the decision between nearshore or offshore, I found out that it's not the offshore location and the height of the wages. It was something completely different.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's interesting. Yeah.
I have a question that we started from the beginning that's been like in the back of my head. I didn't find the right moment to ask it. So, Rolf, you also mentioned the story of yourself going to India and like your perception of the people that not being, good enough or on par. Rini, you mentioned your own story regarding that. My experience has always been, in the beginning maybe there was, but we like quickly were able to surpass that. But there was one barrier that always remained, and that was the client-facing people. So most of the time you have, to some level, some business decision being made in the Netherlands, and then the people that were offshore were doing more of the operational type of work, whereas, let's say, some business analysis or product ownership was always done locally. Now, since COVID has hit, since, let's say, the unthinkable of letting people work from home has happened, maybe this gives more chance for people from these near shore locations to take up, actually finally take up all those roles, and those barriers have been lifted. Have you seen yourself, Rini, experience examples of this? Because I haven't myself yet.
I think you're spot on, and I mean, you know, the only factor that still then remains present is time. So the time zone differences. One of my best friends works for an American company. Due to COVID, he really was in doubt, should I go back to the Netherlands or not? Due to COVID, you know, remote work and working from home was mandatory. So in fact, he's living back in the Netherlands now, and he has adjusted his daily schedule.
Yeah.
Nobody notices. You know, and so I think that will happen. It will happen. And I mean, I hear more situations where companies, due to COVID, now say, well, we now focus on the global workforce. Yeah. And the ones that are working, we're a little bit distributed, now say, maybe we should go for asynchronous.
Yeah. And also focus on a global market. It's a lot easier also for the global market to accept global suppliers.
Yes, depending, of course, on the market they are supplying, because, I mean, there are still country laws and stuff for the stuff you're delivering. Not, let's say, that a bookkeeping package from the Netherlands can automatically be shipped to India and be used over there, because the tax laws and stuff are different and stuff like this. So in that sense, we should be careful just to say, you know, everything is fully global. But I do agree, you know, that from the workforce perspective, especially in knowledge work, I mean, there's no limitation. A time zone could be one, or sometimes language. I mean, we're talking to the English with each other, at least a bit of stone cold English. From my side. But I think, you know, also in the language, I think we should not forget that has a certain factor. Yeah. I am now also today looking for a certain words. And I'm pretty okay in expressing myself in English, but still I can express myself in Dutch better.
Yeah. Sure.
And I think that still, and when you work for Dutch customers, sometimes it's easier to talk Dutch, and not because that's the preferred language, but that's the level of the language and the nuances in the wording, you can communicate stronger and better.
Yeah. So about the location of your friend, because during the whole pandemic, I've been at two customers, and at both customers, there were examples of employees at that company that said, like, I wanted to work from another country. I have to work from home, but I have to do it from the Netherlands. I cannot do it from, like, I don't know, like a tropical island somewhere. Like, the company rules just don't allow for it.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I think that's a matter of time. And I mean, you know,
right.
What is work? And I think, you know, there are some models about that. Let's say the first stage of remote work is playing office. Yeah? So you have to log in at 9 and log out at 5. And we measure the amount of keystrokes during the day or something, you know. I don't believe in this, but that's what's happening. So I think, you know, these rules of that have been made in the past probably had a meaning at the time, or had a necessity at the time. I'm not sure what it was. Maybe it was fear, or maybe it was some valid reason. I think this will change. And I know in the past year, I've met with people, you know, that were so fortunate enough to have a holiday house in Italy. And they said, I have to go in a lockdown anyway. Let's do a lockdown from India, from Italy, because the weather is better over there. And I think, lucky you, you know. And I think that this will change. Like punchies now in Macedonia.
Hey, you got it right.
I'm learning, Punch. I'm learning.
We all are.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that's a matter of time, Rolf. And also for this friend of mine, it took a while. So it was at the end of the first year, the company decided that this remote work is probably going to remain, and they changed the policy.
Right.
Yeah. But it also depends on the company. And it was changing already, of course, right? COVID accelerated this, but it was changing.
And it depends on the type of work. I mean, because we are talking from a software engineering perspective, from a knowledge work perspective, but of course there are also a lot of companies, you know, that are still building physical products.
Yeah.
In Eindhoven, you have this Lightyear company building a car. how would you assemble a car from home? We're not yet that far. And though surgeons can operate via robots, we are not yet that far that the patient and the robot are in the hospital and the surgeon is in his holiday office in Italy doing the operation. Not yet.
Nope.
But I believe we'll get to a stage where that's feasible. And Rolf, if you could, suppose, one year, 10 years from now, you have to undergo a serious surgical operation.
Yeah.
And you can choose. It will be a robot operation. Mm-hmm. But either it's the best Dutch surgeon who will do it from the operating room managing the robot, or you can have the world's best surgeon on the level, the number one, but he will do it remote from New York.
Okay. Well, then then it will probably depend on his internet provider.
Yes.
Actually, I would go one step further. I would expect the robot to come to my home, right?
Maybe even then, if you can create the how do you call this? The
environment.
The environment, the bacteria. Maybe the surgical room is on the car and it drives in front of your
home. Yeah.
Exactly, Sylvester. So I think, you know, one thing that I've learned is that you usually should never predict the future because you're probably always wrong. But what I do remember that if you take a delta to the past, so you know what's feasible 20 years ago, and then you look at that delta, you say, suppose we will have the same delta towards the future, then it's impossible to predict what will go. And I mean, you know, especially with remote work, because in my field of practice, you know, a few remote software engineers, that was the scope of the study.
Yeah.
Now we have billions of people working remotely. So the developments in there, you know, they will go with lightning speeds.
We
haven't seen anything yet. And I mean, the new generations, you know, they are equipped for it. My daughter did her education from bed, you know.
Yeah.
Why get out of bed? You know, just keep your camera off and study from bed, you know. And I was, of course, judging it. But I thought to myself, what if I could have done my study lying in bed when I was young?
Yeah.
How cool would that have been?
Well, I don't know, because like I, when I did my studies, I was still living at my parents' house, so I did not like rent an apartment in the city. And you know, looking back, I kind of regret it. You know, I would have liked probably to have like maybe 1 or 2 years of like the student life, but probably not in the best interest of my study, but more to just hang out and drink beers. So I guess nowadays...
But you do in the night, Rolf, and then the day you're in bed attending the lectures.
Yeah.
But Rolf, that would have... So fully focused on study, developed your, what is it, technical side of skills, and being in the student, university world, would have developed more of your collaborative side, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. First law of Rini, get drunk together. Exactly. I'm going to remember this one.
Yeah. All right. One last thing that I was wondering about, because like we're talking a whole lot about all the tools that might be there and like the things that you have to work on with your team. But one of the tips that you also give are really short sprints. Of course, that's assuming that companies are doing Scrum. Of course, maybe not all companies are actually using that. What would be an ideal working situation for, well, in our case, software engineering teams be in terms of like working together? Because there's also like mob programming, pair programming, trunk-based development, you know, continuous deployment. What would, in your vision, be like the ideal remote working situation?
It's good that you start off as sprint. The sprint term is a Scrum term.
Yeah.
It's more about short iterations.
Right.
The thing is that when you introduce distance, and we talked about communication, when you introduce distance into communication, I mean, immediately you will cause more or more stringent or more evil misunderstandings.
Right.
And the thing that I realized myself after some thinking, you probably, you were smarter, you recognized it first, is that the misunderstanding is not a problem.
Okay.
It's the time between the cause of the misunderstanding, the recognition, and the fixing of it. So, and that's what distance does. It makes the time between the discovery of the misunderstanding longer. And that's why, you know, in the past when we were offshoring or nearshoring, we send specifications to India for 6 months of work, and then after 6 months they would come back with everything that was wrong in the specification, which they didn't understand, and in the meantime the environment changed. That was not a, it was again the setting. It was the time between asking and delivering and getting the feedback and finding it out. And I think, you know, if you look what Agile has brought to us, or maybe triggered by Scrum and let's get it off all the hype and the bogus, if you go back to the core of it, it's iterative delivery.
Yeah.
And it's been, you know, having an idea, trying it out, see if it works. And if it works, fine, we've learned. And if it doesn't work, fine, we've learned as well, and let's fix it.
Yeah.
So the shorter the iterations become, the better it is. So I don't believe that teams, you know, that started to work with Agile, that, let's say, well, Scrum is their end state. I think they will take several of the skills and the mentality and the mindset into it, and then they continue, whether you call it DevOps or you call it continuous delivery. I don't really care, but I think in the end, you know, it will be continuous shipping, continuous delivery and stuff, but it will be continuous experimentation.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the starting point comes, is that, let's say, that when I think I'm right, that's confidence that I'm right. But it has to be, together with it comes the obligation to test whether that's actually true in this specific setting.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if you get in this stage, then it becomes shorter. And then let's say the situation determines what's the best iteration role. I don't believe you can set a perfect iteration length. Just as when you work for Scrum, you know, you can't say the ideal sprint length is a month, or the ideal is 2 weeks or is a week. It depends on the setting.
Yeah.
The only thing I hope is that the time of the iteration is short enough that if you learn something, you still have enough time to fix that before the real problem gets to you. So, but then shorter is always better.
Yeah, that would be the ideal sprint goal, right? Shorter. Yeah.
Shorter. And it's also, it's interesting that you now mention this, because I think, you know, something, the first time I've heard this, and people thought, I said, so we should deliver faster.
No.
And then when people said it has to be faster, then I hear working harder, overtime, working. No. And the moment in time where, you know, somebody tried to explain this to me was when I met Ken Beck. I think it's 8 years ago or something. I met Ken Beck, and he was saying to me, "But ship faster." So I said, "Oh, should we should ship more often?" He said, "No, really. It's the other way around." I said, "Other way around." And he said, "Well, you should look why it takes now so long. So you should look at the factors that hinder you from shipping faster.
Yeah.
So what are the things that make you slow? So what are the things that make you have an iteration length of a week? What hinders you to make an iteration length of a day? And then you get the stuff that makes you slow. So if you take away the stuff that makes you slow, then you immediately get faster.
Yeah.
I think this is brilliant, because this will also lead you to look at different aspects. How's the team working together? Who's getting our requirements? Why don't we do this stuff ourselves? And
so what's holding you down? What's making you slow? And in the early days, we'll call this blockings, or we call this impediments or something. But again, it's a disqualification.
And
even if we call another department an impediment, or you call a person an impediment, I mean, you know, then things go wrong. But as soon as you start to look at it from a systemic perspective, and you look at, you know, what are the things that keeping us from shipping more often? You know, what are the things that are making us slow? And the thing is, if you take something away, maybe that's a little bit of work, but you immediately get slower. And I think the strange thing is, in normal life, we do this. If you're running and you want to run faster, you just lose 5 kilos.
Yeah,
and then you run faster. It's not because you have to work harder.
Just,
you have to
that's work, easy.
You, you have to work less. You know, to run faster, you need less energy. It's a brilliant system, but that's the way to look at it. So short iterations are almost obliged when you work remotely, because of the impact and the number of misunderstandings. The misunderstandings will be there. And it's okay. You know, they were already there when we were in the office, only then the time between the cause of the misunderstanding and the fix, it was so short that we often didn't even notice.
Right.
Sometimes wasn't even feasible, because in the discussion that we had and working together, the stuff got fixed. Now when we work remotely, it will be there. And you don't want to find out a month later that somebody misunderstood you if you could have fixed it in a day, or maybe in an hour, maybe in a minute, or maybe in a second. So the iterative working, I think you cannot work remotely successfully if you're not working as iteratively as possible?
Well, I think it kind of makes the problems more visible, but the same problems exist in real life, if you will, right?
Yeah.
So a sprint length should always be shorter. A remote, it makes it even more clear that it should be. But I could actually imagine kind of like a 24-hour mob programming session going on, right? People joining from all over the world and just continuing with work, staying in flow. I think it would be brilliant. Kind of like a cool goal for next year.
And when you're coding away, you know, time isn't there anyway.
Yeah.
And if you judge on the result and not on the effort.
Yeah.
You know, I think and I think that's the future we will go towards. And I hope we're going to see this. Maybe it's the next generations, I'm not sure. But I think, you know, there's so much to develop and to learn. You know, this whole remote working, I mean, it's still in its infancy. I think we haven't seen 10% of what's feasible.
Yeah. Well, if I can speak personally, like I live in the north of the Netherlands near Groningen, and I've had a lot of clients in Utrecht and Amsterdam and Den Haag and stuff like that. So I'm kind of used from working remotely. So I hope it is here to stay and to become, better and better, because I have a self-interest in that regard, that I like working for those clients over there, but I like living where I live. And, I find it a very nice way of working, at least.
Yeah, I think it will. I think this will become the de facto. And of course, maybe sometimes you have to travel. Maybe they travel to you because, you know, it's beautiful up north. So I think, you know, that we live in interesting times. And I think, you know, though all the personal dramas and all the things that happened, you know, you can't say that COVID is great, you know.
It's
personal dramas and all stuff over. I think, you know, but it did help in building a skill set in the digital transformation of our society, which, let's say, we will look in hindsight 10, maybe 20 years from now. We can really pinpoint, you know, when did we really speed up? When did we really accelerate it? That will pinpoint to the COVID era.
I'm
pretty sure.
The next revolution.
Whether it will be a revolution, you know, that's for the historians to determine. Yeah. But I think
this
period.
Cool. All right. So, I think that's it for me. I don't know if you guys have any questions for Rini, or Rini, if you have any questions for us.
Yeah, of course. I'm really interested because you've recorded more of these podcasts.
Yeah.
What was one of the questions that, let's say, in the preparation you wanted to ask? I mean, you didn't wonder. That was always the fun question to ask to a candidate or somebody who joins you.
Like a fun question?
Yeah. The most surprising answer you got, or
most surprising answer?
Oh, from another podcast, you mean?
Yeah.
Is that what you meant?
Yeah. Because we've been talking so content and so.
And the thing is, we rarely we always have a few talking points before we start this conversation, right? But the conversation always goes everywhere.
Okay, then I want to know what's your guilty pleasure, Sylvester, and what's your secret hobby that you want to talk about? Don't want to talk about, Rolf. And what's your favorite song, Panchi, that you're a little bit ashamed of to tell us?
So I can start.
These are actually great questions to build up a team, right?
Yeah.
So personal, get vulnerable.
So I can answer a few of those, I guess. Like my guilty pleasure is I watch Temptation Island on Videoland. So that's one. That's one. And the hobby that I don't really talk about much, but I like painting miniatures. Like I play these board games with miniatures and I paint them. So it's kind of a geeky thing that I don't really talk about that with a lot of people. So man.
So my guilty pleasure, then I'll go second, is find the worst country songs you can find and get in my car and play them way too loud and just blare along.
You have to sing along then.
Well, in the car, it's not really singing, so that's fine.
But when you're alone in the car.
If my kids are in there, they immediately hit pause and it's done. No. Or my wife, actually, so. And hobbies, I think for me, Forest Cats is my hobby, right? It's kind of like, this is where I, it's a different kind of company, to me at least.
Now, Punchy.
The question was for embarrassing songs, and I cannot actually, I actually opened my Spotify to look at, but I think there is one, actually now it's a Serbian artist who is long passed away, but he's like this guy, Tomas Drakovic, and he sang about, like, trashy, like hard loves, but then like it's really for some. You have to think about a trashy place where these type of songs are being sang, and I sometimes just love to listen to those songs. And so there is your connection with Serbia.
Okay, but it's not to say I own all the albums of the Carpenters or something.
Oh no. No, I'm sorry. Could be great. Okay, this is embarrassing. When I was a bit younger, I had this record by East 17, which is like this boy band.
Yeah.
Oh man.
So, now we're getting somewhere. Yeah.
And you knew the lyrics, and you could also do the dances.
Oh, obviously. I mean, obviously.
Show us.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, now it's your turn, Rini.
Oh, my turn. Oh,
yeah, of course.
What did I ask? Guilty pleasures in food, or what was it?
Yeah, guilty pleasure, whatever. Yeah.
Oh, guilty pleasure. I think are the chili cheese nuggets from Burger King.
Yeah.
And sometimes when I'm on the road, I take a box of 20 and I all eat them.
Yeah.
So that's hobbies. Do I have strange hobbies? There's some strange hobbies. Not really, I believe. Yeah, I'm running a foundation with my wife called logierplezier.nl, which organizes weekend stays and holidays for people with disabled children. So it's not a strange hobby, but it's how do you call this? It's for the good hobby.
Yeah.
And songs, you know, I there's only one song that to me, you know, gets me in a strange party mode, and that's Schudden van Def Rhymes. I'm not sure you know it.
Yeah, Def Rhymes. Hell yeah.
In fact, when I turned 45, my wife, how do you call this, hired Def to come and sing it on my birthday.
Oh, brilliant.
Were you starstruck? Embarrassing, or were you like exactly?
No, it's really fun. Really fun. In fact, I kept in touch. So once in a while, we're sending apps to each other. So it's a really fun.
That's
really
cool. That's pretty cool. All right. So that wraps it up for today. Rini, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for the conversation, and good luck with the editing.
Yeah, well, we're not going to edit anything. It's going to just go bam on YouTube for everyone to enjoy. So we'll link.
Delivery, right?
We'll add a link to your books and to your website to the description. So if there's any other thing you would like people to know, that we can put it there. Like, I don't know, if your Twitter feed or whatever.
Or maybe the foundation. Some books or to LinkedIn page or whatever.
Yep.
Whatever. It comes correct.
All right. Cool.
Okay. I had a blast. Sorry, I wanted to say that. I had a blast, Rini. It was a fun
Thank you. Yeah, and also I hope that all the audience, all the listeners and viewers, in especially Macedonia and Serbia, had a great get a great time. And I wish you all a good Sylvester night, guys. No fireworks in the Netherlands. Punchy, maybe? You can do something?
I am actually climbing a mountain tonight. I'm
climbing a mountain. So take care. Meters. Be careful.
Be careful.
Yep. Also climb down, take some champagne, and
exactly
enjoy the new year, guys. 2022. Yeah. It will be a blast.
Thank you, Rini.
Best wishes to everyone. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
See you later. Bye-bye.